Well, okay. So my name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't prepared this in the sort of traditional sense of doing an outline or something. I just thought I'd wing it. And so hopefully that will work. So it's not necessarily going to be very linear. Before we get on to step one, though. You've got to make sure they're ready for step one. It's no good launching into step one unless you've got someone that knows what they're in for. And the thing is with saying, well, how do you get someone to step one? Well, it's almost like the question, how long is a piece of string? Well, it depends how long the piece of string is. It depends on so many different factors. There are so many different types of people who've got so many different types of experience. So I'm going to outline a few different types of person. It won't be exhaustive, but it'll cover some of the main bases. So the first one is someone who is completely new to recovery, completely new to AA. As Margaret Atwood said, doesn't know their ass from a hole in the ground, as far as AA is concerned, and as far as alcoholism is concerned. And if this is the easiest person, in fact, to get to step one, because you don't have to clear lots of wreckage out of the way. And also, they've probably been drinking in the last week or so. So they're usually a little bit chastened by that and just a tiny little bit willing. They don't know they're allowed to argue with you yet. That comes within about 3 or 4 weeks, they figure that out. Someone tells them and then they start to argue. But the really new ones are very good. But I think it's very helpful for people to know a little bit about the fellowship. And so I would always make sure they go to a gazillion meetings. And if their mind is still working, I get them to read the big book up to page 164. A lot of people these days have the rock bottom is higher than it was 20 years ago on average, I think. People seem to be a bit less damaged cognitively than they used to be. It's different with drugs. Some drugs, it's actually the other way around. But with the alcoholics, they tend to be readers, able to read, certainly around here, they tend to be able to read, and that they're often spiritually literate. They've often read spiritual books, which they hadn't 20, 25, 30 years ago, by and large. So you can give them that. If they're not readers, I give them good old-fashioned talks to listen to, like Clancy, who seems to, and Don Pritz, who seem to get through to people very effectively. So they've got some sense of what AA is about. And at the very least, I'll outline why we have the steps in the first place. And of course, you're sort of begging the question, really, because to explain why you need all of the steps, you have to give them a little bit of an understanding of step one. The re steps 2 to 12 are there because of step one, namely that left to my own devices, I'll drink. If I drink, I'm going to drink buckets and I might never stop and it'll kill me. So I need something to change me so I don't have the first drink. People have got to be bought into the whole thing, or it won't work. They won't know why they're doing it. If people understand why they're doing it, there's a much bigger chance that they'll actually do the work which is required and not get too bogged down in step one. There's a lot of material in step one. So that's the person that's totally new. You've got to give them an introduction. The next character is someone who's been bumbling around AA for anywhere between a few months and 2 or 3 years, in kind of good old-fashioned meetings where you go along and people just share about their week and there's a little bit about drinking, a little bit about gratitude, and things are so much better now. I'm not drunk and a few sort of tips so that they haven't really been exposed to the program. And again, these people are there's less work to do with preparation. Normally, if they ask for sponsorship, it's because they've reached a crisis. They've figured out that there's something more than just meetings. And they've isolated you as someone that kind of knows something that they don't. And so the sell is relatively easy there. And there, I definitely get people to read through the first 164 pages. They're physically sober for a while. They're almost always capable of reading. I'll come to the case of people that can't, because I've had that. The hardest case is people who've been 5, 10, 15, 20 years in AA with or without relapsing. They've been to 100,000 meetings. They've, in inverted commas, been through the steps a number of times, but they're still crazy. And they've got all sorts of little bits of knowledge, but it doesn't add up to anything because all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle haven't been put together. There, you've got to come at it very differently because they sort of know everything already. They might know all the individual bits of information, but as I say, they haven't put them together. And there, the sell is why what I'm offering with a path through the big book is different than what they've been doing. And I simply do that with my own experience about how when I did AA piecemeal with little bits here and little bits there, I got some progress and some results, but it fell short of getting the rocket into orbit. To get the rocket into orbit, every single NASA needs to get everything right. If it gets one thing wrong, if it misses one thing, the rocket ain't going into orbit. There might be a big bang somewhere, but it ain't going to get into orbit. So again, that's a different question. And also, there are lots of problems with taking someone through step one if they've been through the steps before, but are nuts or all over the place, or they've drunk again or something like that. Because what you've got to do is undo a whole load of stuff before you build afresh, before you build anew. So people need to know what they're in for. They also need to be prepared for some hard work. So, and I don't make any bones about this. And you sort of, I do it slightly apologetically. I say, well, I was, it's very, I'm sorry to have to break this to you, but it's going to be hard work. And I totally understand if you don't want to do it. I wouldn't want to do it unless I absolutely had to. My friend Tom says, you want to hold out as long as you can. You want to don't rush into this. And it says in the big book about, you know, if he wants to proceed straight away, don't let him. Make sure they think over it for 24 hours. Otherwise, they'll say you rushed them if you go into it. What I've got to prepare people for is this. It's a little sequence. Number one, do you have a problem? What's your problem? And you've got to isolate the fact that there is a problem with the substance. One actually interesting thing, a lot of people who've been sober a while don't think they've got a problem with alcohol anymore. They think, well, you know, now I've got a thinking problem, not a drinking problem, and now I've got life problems, not realizing that unless those are solved adequately with a spiritual awakening, they're going to drink again. It's not. The other steps are not disconnected from step one. The steps are there because of step one, and the benefit to one's life is the side effect. So they've got to recognize there's a problem, that they've got the problem that the steps are there to solve. They may have 100 other problems too, but have they got the problem that the steps are there to solve? Namely, a mind which is so broken, they need a power greater than themselves to be the higher authority to turn to, so that as Grady OH says, you want to put your life in the hands of God because God isn't thirsty. They've got to recognize that number one, they've got a problem. Number two, they don't have a solution. And to recognize whatever solution they think they've got so far in totality hasn't worked. So the whole thing's got to be set aside completely. Otherwise, any new information you give them, if it's consistent with what they already know, they'll let it in, they'll admit it. If it's inconsistent, that their antibodies will reject it, and they'll end up no further ahead because they'll only admit the information that is consistent with their existing worldview. So there's got to be the sense that although you may have, you know, the person may have achieved a lot and understood a lot and learned a lot, everything needs to be set aside. Anything which is true and good and useful will come back through the course of the process. So they won't be permanently getting rid of anything useful. They're just temporarily setting it aside. And to do that, the best way, I had someone say to me, this was a sort of it was someone on a tape, but they were, as it were, having a dialogue with the audience, and I was listening to the tape, so I was having the, part of the dialogue, and it went something like this, how old are you? And I thought to myself at the time, I'm 30, I don't know, 34, whatever I was, 34, 35. And are you happy? No, was the answer. I struggled to get to that, initially. Well, I'm not sure. I'm happier than I used to be. I'm happier than lots of people I know. I'm happier than the people at my home group. But fundamentally, there were things I was unhappy about, and that poisoned the whole thing. And it then went like this. So you've been trying for 35 years to be happy, and you're not happy. If your plan was ever going to work, don't you think it would have kicked in by now? If it hadn't kicked in by now, when do you think it was going to kick in? So I had to admit complete defeat. And it doesn't take long. This is a 24-hour, 48-hour process with people to admit the complete. I don't find it takes long. Just the question needs to be asked. Are you happy? No. Do you want to set aside everything you think you know for a new experience? Yes, good. Are you willing to let go of your old ideas? And are you willing to go to any lengths? If they say yes with, are you willing to go to any lengths? I've got a daily program that I give people. Actually, there's a little note I'm going to put in the chat if the chat, does the chat work? Yes. I can't remember what that link even is now. Oh yeah. Oh, by the way, icebreaker questions. That's the icebreaker questions. That's to get to know them. I adjust those. If they're super new, half those questions won't make sense. So I've got a different version for people who are totally new. But you want to get as much information about them as possible so that you know how to pitch it. But the thing, if they say they're willing to go to any lengths, I just sent a second link, which is the daily program. And that also includes basically the notion that they're going to be doing step work daily. Schedule it first thing in the morning, because then it won't get bounced by anything. So go to bed early, get up super early, get up before the cat gets up, get up before the kids get up. Do your step work early, because then you've spent all day smugly thinking, I've done my step work today. And you can tell everyone you've already done your step work. Like everyone you speak to, you can brag about that. If you leave it till night, number one, it won't happen. Number two, you create guilt. And then the guilt actually prevents you from doing it because you don't want to admit the guilt. So you pretend the cause of the guilt is not there. And then you forget to do your step work, and you're not forgetting, you're repressing the knowledge of it, so you don't need to feel guilty about it. Best way around that, do it in the morning. I always get sponsees now, if they do some step work, to find a gang of little people who have also done the steps, to run the step work past, preferably people who will challenge and not just be nodding dogs. Because once they've talked a topic through with three people, everyone gets everything. I've ceased to have problems with people understanding things. If it's just me trying to explain something, for some reason, that there's something that happens when you're the sponsor, you're the authority figure, and this barrier comes up, and it causes communication problems. However nicey-nicey you do it, you can get it right on your side. If you're the sponsor, you're the problem because you're the authority figure. So sometimes with the initial processing of information, they need to bash it out with someone else, who they don't have an authority problem with. So, and that's what people did with me when I was new. They said, my sponsor said, talk to all your little friends about step one. Don't just talk to me about it. Talk your step four through with all your little friends at your home group, which I did. I did a bit more structured, but I give people a list of people who I know have got a good sound understanding of the program. So the daily program is terribly important because they won't do the work unless it's supported with lots of people, lots of meetings, and something which kind of starts to give them access to a higher power with steps 10, 11, and 12 straight away. Now, as regards step one, I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit longer than I was. Is that all right, Alistair? Okay. Is it such an unusual thing to actually talk about? I kind of don't care. It just takes as long as it takes because it just isn't the opportunity to do this a lot of the time. The actual step one, I'm going to start with the hardest case and then work backwards. The hardest case is people that can't read for educational reasons. And they can read the words. If you ask them to read out the sentences, they can read out the sentences. But the sign is where the biggest sign is when people don't see the full stop as the end of the sentence and they carry on reading as though there isn't a full stop. So they're literally just pronouncing the words. If that's happening with the ends of sentences, it ain't going to go in. You have to read it with them. Line by line and make sure they get it. This is also the case with people who are still acting out with food or sex. I can't read. I've needed to go through it. I had someone that was many years sober but was acting out very badly with sex stuff. And he was trying to put a lid on it, but it was a lot better than it had been, but it was still there. The mind was so scrambled by what he was doing sober that you couldn't give him a page to read and hope that he could come back having heard what the page was saying. He heard a whole load of other things. So we needed to go. We sat day after day, week after week in a coffee shop in East London, just went through it page by page. The problem with that is it can take a long time. It took a bloody long time to get through it. So what you can do is select key passages. And if you want to do a selection of key passages, so you get them to listen on tape. Sometimes people can listen on tape. If it's a nice soothing voice, it actually goes in a way that stuff on the page doesn't. So they listen to the whole thing, but you basically pull out some key passages in the doctor's opinion, get them to listen to Bill's story for identification, key passages in chapter two, and then the key characters, a couple of passages in chapter three and the key characters. So I'll come to the characters later. So you're still going through it with them in detail, but you're not making it take 3 months. It can literally take 3 months if people's minds are super scrambled. And there's a danger of just losing the patient in the process because it's just taking so long. What I've done with a lot of people over the years is not something I do now, but it's very successful. I've got various worksheets I've used for step one with lots of quests, with a bunch of questions for each chapter. And there you can do it in two ways. You can either give them the chapter plus the worksheets, say, have a look at the chapter, have a look at the worksheets, answer the questions, come back, we'll go through them. I go through again, if there's an educational problem or the mind is scrambled, then I'll go through the questions one by one. A third method, and I did this for a while, and this was very good, is get them to read anywhere between 2 and 5 pages at a time. So today you're going to read 2 pages and then you call me and we talk about it. Maybe you call two other people, talk about the 2 pages, then call me and talk about the 2 pages. And then I say, what did you get out of that? What did you understand from that? And they say some very peculiar things. And then I say, well, I think some really interesting points here are dot, dot, dot. You might want to write these down. They're always like, the important bits are never the bits that they spot. But it gives them a chance to interact with the text and kind of make it their own. But you're also pointing out the important bits afterwards. That breaks it down into chunks. Some people can manage, they can't cope with the idea of getting through a book. But you say, can you read 2 pages? They can read 2 pages. If people have been through the steps before and have got some understanding and competence of what is going on. Rather than just going through the book chapter by chapter, Because the kind of the chapters jump all over the place. One minute you're on the problem, next minute you're on the solution, then you're back to the problem, then you're back to Bill's story, then you're back to the solution, then boom, spiritual awakening, then you're back to the problem again. It kind of goes all over the place. So sometimes I do it by topic. And so this is my preferred method at the moment, especially with people who've got some experience, is to do it in this specific order. Physical craving, no such thing as a safe slip. And I'll come back to these one by one. Physical craving, there is no such thing as a safe slip. Mental obsession. And those three together produce the diagnosis. And then there's the prognosis, progressive, fatal, incurable. And then there's a discussion of unmanageability. And then there's a discussion, well, what's the solution? The solution is spiritual. And you can either give them all of those topics. I think I've got a note I can give you on this. There we go. So this is my standard step one note I give people. And it's got some links to some blog articles as well. I don't always give them that. If they're going to have trouble processing lots of material, I don't give them the blog articles. I just say ignore those, just look at the book. So that covers those topics. Because I think step one builds up logically. And if there's any doubt about, so if someone's very competent, I've got someone at the moment who's 30 odd years sober. So I gave them the whole of step one to look at in one go. But often I'll break it down into those individual elements. So the first one, I'll tell you why. I established that they got a problem with drinking. What's a problem with drinking? You're drinking so much that you get consequences which after the event you regret. I mean, at the time you take them in your, so I would take them in my stride. You tell me before a drink what the consequences are going to be. I'm fine. Afterwards, when they've hit, I'm not so fine. So that's someone who's got a drinking problem. You're drinking enough that you get consequences that after the event you don't want. And you look at the question of, well, solution number one is can you moderate? And if the answer is, if your experience is that you haven't, then it means you can't. And the simple way it was put to me, and I think this works very well, if you know that moderation is an answer to drinking too much and you didn't do it, you're either powerless or you're, what, if not, what are you? Are you mad? Are you dumb? I mean, you don't seem to be either of those. So if you're not powerless, what are you? And that's the unanswerable question. And that's really straight from the doctor's opinion. It doesn't satisfy us to be told that we couldn't control our drinking just because we were in full flight from reality, mad, outright mental defectives. You just don't have the brain cells to rub together, or in full flight, or were maladjusted to life, unhappy. None of those make sense. And so the only thing you're left with is powerless. Now, the reason it's so important to get this done first, if someone is equivocating about whether or not they can moderate, they need to solve that, because the question of would I be insane to have the first drink is only a question if having the first drink is an insane thing to do. If you might be able to moderate, it wouldn't be insane to have the first drink. So the mental obsession is all about insanity. And that can't be a question unless you've got the physical craving down. So you've got to get the physical craving understood first. And there's a pivot point in the book. When I go through the book in a linear way, so page by page, bottom of 22, top of 23, it says that's the pivot point where it finally draws a line under the physical craving and says, right, now we've established that when you drink, you have little control over the amount you take. Oh, no, it's a different quotation. That's it. When you have a drink, something happens in the bodily and the mental sense which makes it virtually impossible to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly prove this. And then it says, If that be if that's the case, then the problem is in the mind, i.e. the mind which gets you to have the first drink in the first place. But you the premise behind everything else on step one is that you can't drink without drinking too much. And there's the one thing almost everyone, especially even the slippers, is totally down with the idea that, you know, one drinks too many and a thousand aren't enough. They're down with that. What they're not down with is the corollary of that, which is if that's the case, you can't, there is no such thing as a safe slip because you literally might never come back because you have a slip on one day. If you slip on one day, you're much more likely to slip on the next day too. And I always give the example of my poor old friend Paul, who started drinking. He was the same age as me, started drinking in 1995. It's 2021, and the last I heard, he'd left AA again. Harry, you may know what's happened to him if he's back or not. But 26 years later, and the poor kid still isn't back. And that started with a slip, which started with one day of drinking. So there's no such thing as a safe slip. And once you've got that, if you understand that you not only do drink too much and do terrible things, but you might literally not come back from that slip, then you've got a legitimate question. Am I the sort of person that would be crazy enough to have the first drink? By the way, the story for There's No Such Thing as a Safe Slip is the man of 30 who could stop once, stops for 20 years, starts again, and then can't stop. Once you've established that you've got the physical craving, no such thing as a safe slip, you're into mental obsession territory, and it's downhill from here. Basically, if you've got years of experience, this is how I always put it to people, if you've got years of experience of drink doing bad things, yet that didn't deter you, then again, you're either dumb or you're mad or you're alcoholic. Pick one. Which one is it? Keeps it super simple. People get very wrapped up, but I don't know if I really wanted to give up, and I don't know if I ever really tried to give up. And irrelevant. It's the fact that you didn't. The fact is sufficient. And the key passage is top of 21. Where it talks about if a sufficiently strong reason comes along, a heavy drinker can moderate, but an alcohol or stop, an alcoholic can't. So I get people to give a year. What year? Give me a year when you started to have very bad consequences from drinking. They'll say, well, 1991. And what year is it now? Well, it's now 2021. Say, okay, so for 30 years. Repeatedly, bad experience did not stop you from having the first drink. So the question of whether you could is neither here nor there. If you could have, you would have. And that cuts through that whole thing of whether or not they tried, which is always, I think, is a complete red herring. If you establish that you're the sort of person that for whom experience doesn't consistently keep you away from the first drink. You're the sort of person who then drinks excessively and is minded to keep doing so because it just seems normal at that point. Then the diagnosis is done. And there's an interesting line on 21 where it says, at some point in the drinking career of every alcoholic, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So I said, okay, what age did you first start to lose control of your liquor consumption? I'll say, give me an age. And I'll say, well, the first time I, you know, overshot was when I was 40. Okay, you've been a real alcoholic since you were 14. Often they think they've been a real alcoholic since last May or last Thursday, whereas in fact, they've been a real alcoholic since, you know, the Callaghan government, which was the first time that they overshot. So your key, if people can't take, some people can not hold more than four or five ideas in their brain because they're so frazzled from drinking drugs. If you can't do anything but this, you look at 21. Did you have bad experiences from drinking? Yes. Did you moderate? No. Did you stop? No, you're an alcoholic. How long have you been alcoholic? When was the first time you overshot? 1984. You've been an alcoholic since 1984. Would you like a solution? You can kind of do it in 60 seconds. So that's the diagnosis. The prognosis is very straightforward. There are three ideas: progressive, fatal, and incurable. And those pretty much speak for themselves. Progressive, fatal, and incurable. Unmanageability, there's it is one of those things where it throws it into the big book on page 59. It says unmanageable for the first and last time, and it doesn't define unmanageable or unmanageability. And of course, if it's not defined, there are two possible conclusions. Number one, they wrote the book like the Da Vinci Code, hoping that everyone was going to Miss Marple their way into some, secret divine truth, or it was so bloody obvious they didn't need to elaborate because it was so bloody obvious. And it's so bloody obvious that AA collectively has missed the point of what unmanageability is in large part. There are of course people who do get it. There's a tape. Of course, the problem, the what I'm speaking about here is well, I'm not just powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over people, places, and things, and I'm neurotic, and I'm incompetent, and I'm disorganized, and my life is unmanageable, and I'm late for my tea service, and my room is a mess, and I shout at my mother, so my life is unmanageable. And those may or may not be true, but they're not distinguishing features of alcoholics. And lots of alcoholics are not, when they're new, necessarily disorganized, incompetent, and neurotic. It's not what it was about. A lot of people are, I was, but they're not distinguishing features. They're sort of common symptoms. I heard a public information tape, an AA public information tape on prisons many years ago, where there was this sort of Mr. Chumley Warner voiceover. And the voiceover said, there was a sort of actor playing some alcoholic in prison. And the voiceover said, this is Brian. Brian has lost control of his drinking and thus his life. And I thought, blimey, that's the best presentation of step one I've ever heard. If you can't choose whether or not you're going to drink, and when you drink, you can't choose how much you're going to drink, and if you drink too much, you're going to do some strange things, and you can't choose if you're ever going to stop. You're not in control of your life. Whether or not you have a drink is in control of your life. Now, if you're not in control of that, you're not in control of your life. The course of your life is literally determined by whether the switch flicks in your mind and says, let's go to the pub. Now, you may also be mad, but you get bonus points for that. If you haven't turned over your mattress in 6 months, again, you get bonus points, but this is not unmanageability. Now, you've got to be very careful where you say this. If you try to make this point in an AA meeting, you'll get lynched afterwards. Because people are very attached to the idea that unmanageability is being sort of unhappy and very bad at doing things, incompetence. If you're uncertain about what Bill, because we know who wrote the big book, basically it was Bill. Other people had input, but Bill wrote it. 20 years later, he writes the 12 and 12. And they've got a problem because already by then, the unmanageability question had morphed within the AA fellowship. So they had a problem. People, as he puts it in the 12 and 12, with a nice house and two cars in the garage, a job and a house and two cars in the garage, were coming to AA and struggling with the question of whether or not they were unmanageable. Their lives were unmanageable. So he says, well, how do we get them to see their lives are unmanageable? So it's clearly, I mean, he doesn't say, well, if you're doing well on the outside, I'm afraid you can't take step one. You'll have to get sober through some other organization because you have to be neurotic and incompetent to do step one. He doesn't say that. He says, going back through our own drinking histories, we could see that years before the onset of real problems, Our drinking was no mere habit. It was indeed the beginning of a fatal progression. So unmanageability hasn't even got anything to do with consequences. It's got to do with choice. If I am powerless, I am not managed. I am not in charge of my life. The alcoholism is in charge of my life. I'm in the grip of a progression which is bigger than me. The progression is in charge of my life. And that's something that all alcoholics should be able to sign up to. If you understand powerlessness, then the best way it's explained to me, if you don't have the power to adjust the steering wheel, you're not managing the car. You're not in control of the car. You've got to have the power to turn the steering wheel to change the direction of the car. You've got to have the power to stop drinking to change the direction of your life. In other words, to manage the course of your life. That's something that only alcoholics can sign up to, and all alcoholics can sign up to. And that gets around all of those messy problems with unmanageability. And the last point is needing a spiritual awakening. I don't mention God unless I absolutely have to with sponsees in the early stages. Alia will probably laugh at this, but the way I like to explain it is if Susan and Clive used to drink a bottle of gin every day, they did not have the power to stay sober. But now Susan and Clive do not drink a bottle of gin a day. They have acquired the power. They've gone from being powerless to having power. So whatever is keeping them sober is available to me too. One doesn't need to understand the mechanism or where the power comes from. One simply needs to observe that your problem is lack of power. So the answer is axiomatically the acquisition of power. So those are basic elements of step one. And then the last point is the rounding off point is on page 44, where you say, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, then you're probably alcoholic. Now, it's interesting. This is the last point I'm going to make, and then I'm going to stop. It says if either of those two tests are passed, you're alcoholic. Now, I'm told that this is intentional, but I don't know. I have no way of corroborating it. I suppose that now I have. I just haven't asked the chap in question. It shouldn't be or with those tests. It should be and. If I'm compelled to have a drink, but then I can totally keep it to one, I don't have a problem. I'm not an alcoholic. If when I drink buckets, but I can totally stay away from the first drink and it's not a problem, I'm not an alcoholic of the big book variety. Both tests have got to be passed for me to have a problem, which I need AA to solve. And what's fascinating, people guard their reservations because they're frightened of not being able to get through the turnstile of step one, having to kind of leave AA or something. So often people pay lip service to step one. And that test, because it's or, I've had this countless times where people would admit, yeah, I definitely drink too much when I drink, but I could probably stay sober on my own. But it says either or. So, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, or it's the other way around. They say, yeah, I can't stay away from a drink, but, you know, I probably could control it if my life was more under control. But it says or. So, yeah, I am an alcoholic. It inadvertently gets people to. Oh, it gets people to inadvertently reveal reservations that they don't know are going to be obstacles. So that's an incredibly important paragraph. If you get them through that, then you're well on to step two. So I'm going to stop my timer there. And thank you for indulging me for 38 minutes.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Usually what we're... the kind of format is if you'd be okay with it, that we kind of open the floor to ask questions if we have any. Does anyone have any? Well, I had one, so I'm going to jump straight in if that's all right. with working with newcomer sponsees, and that was a great outline of working step one. Do you find, and you outlined the different types that you've come across in your experience, in your experience of, like, we've been meeting people face to face for a long period, and then we've gone into Zoom. I know you sponsor a lot of people around the world. Is there a difference? Do you use a different technique to sponsoring someone you've never met face to face? Do you insist on certain things done differently, perhaps? Or yeah, I'll kind of leave it at that.
It is difficult. I think it's all the more important to get people talking to more people than they otherwise might need to if there were face-to-face meetings. But honestly, what I've been struck by over the last year and a half is I haven't seen any greater likelihood of people slipping or not getting it because it's over the phone and over the internet than face-to-face. I just haven't seen that. There's a line in A Course in Miracles about it's not bodies that join, it's minds that join. And one very curious thing, there's a Course in Miracles teacher who does these remote because, I mean, he's in a particular place, so the sessions he does are remote. And when he does one-to-one sessions, he does them over the phone, not on a video call, because he says the visuals are distracting. You'll hear what's going on in the voice much better if you can't see them in front of you. Now, the one thing to watch, I'm a sort of extremely aggressive A-type personality, which is not exactly to everyone's taste. I find myself much gentler with people face to face. I have to watch it on the phone. I can be very difficult. I'm better than I used to be, but I'm still nowhere near fixed. I do notice I see people's fragility and vulnerability much more readily when I see them face to face. So even if I can't meet them physically, it's super helpful if they come to one of the groups I go to where we can at least see each other on video. If I'm folding laundry, I turn the video off, but otherwise I try and keep the video on. Or if I'm in an office and there are people walking behind me. But I think some of that face-to-face stuff, it's amazing how much you can read when you just see people even on a video screen about where they are. So I think the important thing with the face-to-face thing is to see what's going on emotionally behind the actual words. But I think that's all I've got on that. But from a pure sponsorship point of view, I think it works just as well over the phone as anything, except with super new people who it's first time. They're the ones who will almost certainly need lots of face-to-face hand-holding.
Harry? Hey, is it time to ask questions? Thanks, Tim. I had a question about, so sometimes it's a straightforward alcoholic case, and sometimes it's, well, my problem is alcohol and coke, and I've been making opium tea, and I can't stop shagging around. And so how do you take them through a rainbow step one?
Okay, this is a nightmare. Right. First of all, if they have a substance in the mix, I've got to have one substance in common. If I don't have one substance in common, they need to find someone with a substance in common. Although with the one substance or one other addiction. So I've had people who are drug addicts and sex addicts. And it works because of the sex side of things. You know, there's the real kind of visceral connection on that front. There's got to be some visceral connection. If you've got the visceral connection on one substance or behavior, you can cross apply it to everything else. And now you can do everything under one roof, except for food, sex, and romance. I think are the three main ones where you can't. I'll come to the Al-Anon question in a moment. That's a slightly different question. Basically, the behavior needs to stop or be massively reined in for any of the step work to work. So the sexual acting out has basically got to stop, or certainly the acting out which involves other people. Similarly with the food, someone who's in full-blown anorexia will not hear a word you're saying. So what I do with, I don't have food problems in the same way as people who go to OA. So I can't step one, two and three them. And they also, the food people need a plan. And the people do plans in very different ways. You know, people in OA argue about this. It's like Christianity. There are lots of different ways of being an OA and none of them agree. And they don't even talk to each other. But I tell people to go, I give them a list of people, say, you need to go and do a, let's say they're an AA and OA, you need to go to an OA meeting every week, you need to do a step one, two and three, and then the two programs merge when it gets to step four. And either, you know, do the rest of the steps with them or do the rest of the steps with me, but don't try and do two sets of steps four through nine with two people at once. That's completely mad. That doesn't work. And it's, so that's true with food. It's also true with the sex addiction stuff. And I encourage people to, go to a SLAR meeting every week or an SA meeting or an SAA meeting. Again, totally different approaches, different flavors, but to get bottom lines in place. And if they do SLAR, they do the daily questions after the relapse. That's super important. With the kind of drugs and, drink, the only carve outs where the, I think they need specialist input because there's something different going on is pills. So barbiturates, benzodiazepines, amphetamines, opiates and opioids, and hypnotics, those are your basic classes. If they've got a little pill thing going on, there's a deviousness, like with anorexia, there's a particular deviousness with the and charm which go together. I get them to talk to people with a pill history because they can wheedle through into what's going on inside the rationalizations behind the pills in a way that, so I don't have a pill history. So if it's pills, I get them to talk to a pill person. If they're in the whole kind of crystal meth and sex combined with sex scene, they need to be going to CMA and talking to other people who've been in that scene again, because that's incredibly hard not to relapse in, and you need incredibly strong support around you. So I'm all for getting multiple support on one, two and three, but you kind of need one sponsor to take you through the process of 1 through 12 with the other kind of, you know, the 1, 2, 3 waltz and all the other fellowships as a kind of bolt on, but that you don't want like fully separate programs. Otherwise it becomes super confusing. Does that answer the question, Harry?
Yes. One quick thing is quite often I will get, I'm just powerless over everything. So I try to get them to be very specific about what it is, because otherwise we're just, the level of specificity. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a very important point with that. Sometimes people can hide the gravity of a particular thing, which is going to kill them within 3 months, by just saying, you know, I'm powerless over trees and I'm powerless over Netflix and I'm powerless over the, you know, and it diminishes the gravity of the thing which is actually killing them. I know it's a bit naughty of me to do this, but I'm not keen on the notion of primary and my drug of choice. If you're dead, you're dead. And it's not like the family are going to say, well, I'm so glad it wasn't his primary addiction which killed him. It's only the secondary one. If you're dying, you're dying. With the Al-Anon step one, what I get them to do, the Al-Anon step one, I think it requires a subtlety and a sophistication. It's like AA. You don't need to know anyone to get into AA. You need to know someone to get into Al-Anon. The step one, I think, is, I mean, Ellie Shaver can correct me on here. It can be, it's a tough sell, the Al-Anon step one. It's, there are layers there. It takes people some defrosting. If someone is like, let's say this is a very common combination, purely alcohol when it comes to substances, but adult child of alcoholic, maybe married to an alcoholic, maybe alcoholic children. I get them to concentrate on the AA step one first and get them to do, you know, 100,000 Al-Anon meetings on the side to gradually thaw that side out. And once they've got a fully functioning AA program, then they can formalize the Al-Anon stuff. But my experience with the Al-Anon stuff, it helped me, is the informal stuff, the fellowship, like the hearing the stories, was immensely powerful before I even did the formal work. One problem with the psychologically with the people who are AA and Al-Anon, they will often feel psychologically much more drawn to the Al-Anon stuff. It seems to help much more quickly. And then the alcohol stuff gets ignored and then they're drunk and you don't see them for 10 years. And so if with the Anon stuff, a tiny bit of delay to make sure they're on a firm foundation in firm sobriety or abstinence with whatever the thing which is going to kill them in 6 weeks is really helpful before you get into the subtlety of the Anon stuff. I don't know if Ellie Shaver, do you want to add something on that? Okay.
Anyone else have a question for Tim? And if you want to ask a question and me stop recording, just say, please stop recording.
Hi. If someone has multiple addictions, do they work 1, 2, and 3 with one sponsor, then 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3, and then start working 4 to 12?
What I'll do is I'll do 1, 2, and 3 with them and get them to go to the other fellowships to kind of initiate themselves with the other fellowships. Once they've understood the 1, 2, and 3, like for the first time in one fellowship, they've got the basic ideas, then they'll go and run through, they'll sit for an afternoon with someone in OA and just run through how the ideas, let's say it's food. There's an OA meeting in London where they use the big book. So I've got a list of people from there. So if I send them to one of those people, they'll get something which is big book consistent. They won't get confused. So I take them through the first three steps myself on the AA side and then get them to go and sit with Cara for an hour to do 1, 2, and 3 in OA. But it doesn't take long because they've already done it. They just need to understand how the same principles they've already understood apply to the other thing. And maybe there's a bit more work they need to do and they'll need to do food plans or agree some kind of, you know, daily calling in thing. And then it's like tributaries to a river. Once you've, you know, that like each 1, 2, and 3 in let's say AA and SA and OA are there, the three tributaries come together and you've got a single program going forward on steps 4 through 12. Does that make sense? And then actually just one thing, and rather like with a river, when it gets to the coast can sometimes form a delta. When it gets to step 12, that they're going to need some special input from about how to sponsor, you know, how do you sponsor an anorexic? How do you sponsor a sex addict? How do you sponsor someone with pills? You need to find someone that's got that specific experience. So again, it spreads out again when you get to that part of step 12, because there are different major differences between the fellowships there.
I've one question with the newcomer who say to me, could you sponsor me? But by the way, I'm gonna take. I have a problem with alcohol, but I don't have a problem with acid, and I'm going to be taking acid this weekend. He said, he doesn't wake up, and so it's like, well, okay, do you want to do this, or you don't? But do you have any experience?
Yeah.
Alcohol in any form at all.
It's tricky. I think we've got to understand that the notion of sobriety, for me, and other people are allowed to have a different notion of it, is the notion of being free of any influences so that I can appreciate life full on. So whatever I'm experiencing because that's the experience of life I'm creating myself, not because of it's been chemically induced. There are people in AA that will sponsor people who are on all sorts, who do all sorts of things. I mean, ayahuasca, for instance, is something that you know, there's a notion of California sober, where you're sober on alcohol, but you know, who knows what else is slipping under the radar. And so I don't judge that. I don't say it's just not for me. So what I'm interested in is, wouldn't it be fun to discover what you can make of life without any chemicals? If you want something else, going to need to find someone that's made a success of doing that. But there's a Jim Willis quotation. I'm struggling to, I wish I could find it, but maybe I can. Just give me a sec. Is it here? No, I can't find it. I'll send it to you later, Alison, and maybe you can forward it to people if they're interested in it. One thing Jim Willis said, it's in his workbooks. He says, you need a clear head for this process. Whatever the addiction is, whether it's food or sex or alcohol or whatever, you need to be abstinent to have a clear head. And he says a chilling line. We know of no program, so people who are still using, we know of no program that can help such people. So if I've got someone that's just all over the place because they're still fully in another addiction, there's often nothing you can do. You just have to go to 100,000 meetings and hope that something gives that graces you abstinence or with the desire to be abstinent. But no, I wouldn't take someone through that is committing to taking drugs. Medication is maybe a different question. It is a different question, but not an entirely straightforward one either. But we haven't got time for that today.
Anyone else? Any questions or?
I just found that quotation from Jim, by the way. Helpful to have that to hand.
Okay, if anybody else has any questions, I think they're... It down. Should we close with the Serenity Prayer? And, yeah, I'd like to say thank you very much, Tim, for coming along, and ask you to close us out, if you could.
Thank you. Would you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity, to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Nice. Thanks, Tim.
Well, thank you for being there. Would have made no sense me just talking to a screen. So,
thanks, Alice.
I've let out all the trade secrets now, haven't I? Everyone will be sponsoring.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, have a good evening, everyone. Good to see you all.
Bye.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you. Bye-bye.
See ya. Alistair, do you have a Google document or someplace that has all the previous recordings that everyone can listen to?
We have recorded one before, and well, actually, I'm still recording now. I can stop recording now.